Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing cannabis legalization in Ghana. I'm joined by a very special guest, Chennai Kitchen. Chennai is a PhD student in interdisciplinary studies at the British Columbia University, where she also doubles as a graduate research assistant at the British Columbia Center on Substance Use. Chennai, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. So let's start off. Ghana is the latest among a few countries in Africa that have legalized cannabis. Do you want to explain what is the significance of this and the scope of Ghana's legalization of cannabis?
Yeah, sure. So that's a very good, interesting question to start off with, because I think a lot of people, when they talk about legalization, they think it's a free-for-all for accessing things like cannabis. But within the context of Ghana specifically, what this law or policy does, it does not legalize cannabis generally. What it has done is provided a framework for medicinal cannabis and industrial hemp cultivation. So that's very distinct from what people might think is actually happening. So in much of the context of African countries that have moved towards like policies that similarly legalize access to the cultivation of cannabis and hemp in Africa, what this current policy has done has provided people ways to license their cultivation, the processing, the import and export of specific cannabis products. And these cannabis products aren't the ones that are usually found within the recreational markets, in the sense that what people will be growing will be of a less psychoactive content than what people use on the streets, perhaps to try and get high. So basically what is being legalized is the growing of a certain variety of cannabis that is not associated with the use of cannabis for intoxication. So that's what this policy does. And things like using cannabis for your own recreational purposes are still illegal in this context. Personal possession is still illegal as well. Informal cultivation as well as unlicensed trade is still a criminal offense. And there are restrictions to who can access these licenses to be able to grow these products. So I think continentally, it's a similar trend that we've seen in other African countries that have moved in a similar way in terms of policy-wise. Countries like Lesotho, Zimbabwe, South Africa, they've also moved in a similar way. But Ghana is specifically distinct in that they're one of the first ones in the West African region to move in this way. So it kind of signals a certain shift in that sort of way, but it is a similar policies to what we've seen in other African contexts.
So what you've made clear now, it's we have different, for those that may not really understand the different varieties, do you want to expatiate on that, like the different varieties of cannabis? You mentioned one that has a psychoactive, kind of like point for getting intoxicated. And do you want to explain the different varieties that exist?
Yeah, sure. So when we talk about cannabis, it is important to note that there are two main compounds within the cannabis plant itself that are of interest. The main one is called THC, tetrahydrocannabidiol. And that is the main compound that is associated with getting high, I guess. And then there's another major compound, which is called CBD or cannabidiol. That compound is associated more with like therapeutic applications of cannabis use, like treating things like anxiety, insomnia is another one that is associated with THC use. So when people talk about cannabis, they're talking about those two distinct compounds and in what level of concentrations that they're in. So there is I'm not sure if it's a scientifically backed figure of like 0.3%, anything above 0.3% of THC, which is the psychoactive compound, is considered cannabis for recreational purposes. So with this policy, it has essentially said that the cannabis that is going to be grown is of a lower THC content. So it should be below 0.3%. So this is a measure that's been used globally to kind of control what kind of cannabis is being grown. So this policy, it only allows cannabis, which is of 0.3% below of THC. So that type of cannabis is specifically used for things like industrial purposes, and it's classified as hemp, which is distinct from cannabis. So hemp is used in a lot, again, like agricultural purposes, animal feed, just to name a few. So that's the kind of cannabis that we're looking at and talking about when we talk about this policy specifically.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned South Africa and other places in the south, like Lesotho, Zimbabwe, Rwanda as well in the east, that have legalized these in different. But for South Africa, I've read somewhere that South Africa is the only one that has legalized for recreational use, where you have where a person can possess up to 600 grams, which is, I don't know if that is up to the 0.3% you've mentioned, or if it's less or more. Is that correct? I don't know.
Yeah, so South Africa is distinct in that it actually has moved to decriminalize cannabis use. So when we talk about decriminalization, we're talking about removing criminal penalties for cannabis use. So if someone is caught with a certain amount of cannabis that is considered to be for personal use, like you said, 600 grams, that person won't be subject to dealing with the criminal system. They might receive a fine if they have anything above that amount, or perhaps something like a ticket. It just depends on the context. But in that case, South Africa is distinct. And it's also distinct in that it also provides a infrastructure for people to access medicinal cannabis as well. So South Africa is distinct in that way as well, including a few other countries, I think like Seychelles and Mauritius, that are similar in terms of policy. So I think that's what is happening differently compared to what is happening in other countries that have moved towards more of a cannabis for profit kind of policy.
So, but if we look at it generally in Africa, for instance, and we look at the criminalization of cannabis and place that in the paradox of its usage, its illegal usage, which is I think it should be one of the most abused substance in Africa. And is there any cultural what I was going to say, is there any you know, like how sometimes when we talk about maybe the LGBTQ, where there's a cultural perception where the populace. So I guess what I'm saying is, what is the because policies should again also reflect popular perception or how people, if there's any cultural backing against it. What is the, is there any cultural backing or cultural disdain towards and how does that influence these policies? So I guess the question is, if you look at Ghana, which is our focus, how did we get to this policy being enacted and Ghana being the first in West Africa? Is there any cultural push? Was there any popular push among the populace? How did we get to that policy? Was there any lobbying? Was there any activism?
Yeah, definitely. There have been a lot of groups that have moved to make this possible. I am aware of a couple of civil society organizations that have long lobbied for having cannabis more less stringently regulated. Mm-hmm. But I think perhaps there has been a lot of reference to the cultural significance of cannabis, like you were trying to mention. Which was something that was more prominent prior to colonization, where cannabis was something that was used in not only recreational ways, but it found like a range of medicinal applications across the continent. Like we saw midwives using it for as an anesthetic. We saw like forager groups in DRC using it to treat things like stomach worms. So there were a range of applications, and there were also cultural traditions which use cannabis for like traditional ceremonies. And we still do see that to this day. For instance, in like Rastafarian movements and groups, you see the significance of cannabis within their own culture and religion. So you do get a lot of influence from those groups in trying to make cannabis less restringent, less controlled. Mm-hmm. So the significance of culture in getting to this point is there, but I think perhaps it's not aligning with what was being demanded from those groups. Because again, this policy is largely to move towards a more grow cannabis and then export cannabis, and then not necessarily change how people within those communities and cultures are able to use cannabis for their own personal reasons without being stigmatized. So it's distinct, but the significance of the culture is there. Do I think it was like a primary driver to getting to this policy? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something that's quite significant, but I'll come to that in a minute, the commercialization side, you know, basically challenging the motive. So we'll come back to that in a minute. But I was going to talk about, so we see places in the US, for instance, where there has been a long-term campaign for linking that to the decriminalization of cannabis. For instance, you look at the prisons of Accra, whether it's worth it, you know, putting someone in jail for having cannabis and stuff like that. And we've seen in states, like I think in California, there's people have licenses to grow cannabis now. I know my Tyson has acres of land where they grow cannabis. So I guess the question is, if I look at that, what's happening outside of the continent and in the continent, do you think there is a global shift as well? Is Africa moving towards that global shift? Or is Africa's movement, though still limited, is it internally, or is it also being influenced by all this kind of global conversation around criminalization and decriminalization of cannabis and the overcrowding of prison, or you know, all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I definitely think that the global shift in cannabis use has also reached Africa. Like what we see in the States, like right now, it's there is like legislation that is moving cannabis from a substance that is essentially regulated as being something that is of no medicinal use and of like highest threat to the public to a substance that has therapeutic value. So that's something that's like happening right now as we speak. And I think that sort of change in a country, like in such a big country like America, is definitely something that is being looked at more closely, perhaps by other African markets. And I think in general, like looking at the global medicinal cannabis market or the global cannabis market, it is worth over tens of billions of dollars. And I think for anyone who has like a largely agrarian economy, such as like African countries, I think they also see that as something that adds to it as being a high value crop. So I think being able to enter into that conversation of shifting perspectives of cannabis around the world is something that a lot of African countries are trying to do through being able to supply product to a lot of markets like in Europe and in the UK itself. So I think this discussion of like industrial development of cannabis markets, of cannabis cultivation, it's something that is being driven by what is happening elsewhere, where we see that there is going to be like more demand and discussion that is like required to understand like which kind of varieties people are moving towards, which kind of crops are more resilient to certain things. So we're just kind of like shifting with the global perspective, but probably not to the same extent where people will be allowed to access cannabis like down at this like the like at a regular store. So I don't think we're getting to that point, but we're getting to a point where we are trying to utilize the current perspective for our own benefit in the way that we see is best fit for the African context.
You've touched on that commercialization aspect of it. So it's also the market. You've mentioned, you know, the scale of the market in terms of its value and how it's bigger. So when we talk about that as well, you talk about how Africa is plugging into that. So how does that create some level of parity, or will it also entrain some disparity? Because again, I guess the licensing now, let's say Ghana, for instance, how is it easy to get the license? Who are the people able to get a license? Is it a costly process? Is it something that small scale farmers, you know, because you can't access, can't get this license, or does it create some sort of, is it for the wealthy? Does it create some kind of an economic disparity or widening of the gap?
I think to access like licensing through this policy, it's probably gonna be something that has significant barriers for probably the local like farmer, like subsistence farmer in like a rural area, just given to the extent of financial costs that go into getting these licenses. We've seen in countries like Lesotho, where they do have a similar policy, that largely, like most of the cultivation is largely export oriented. And that's where the licensing has occurred. But for like smaller stakeholder inclusion, it's really limited. And that comes with things like being able to show proof of financial capacity. You have to, I think in certain cases, you have to show that people are able to securely secure a premises for cultivation of cannabis, as well as you have to show significant planning in terms of how you're going to store the product, how you're going to export the product, and what you're going to do with any product that isn't used. So there's a lot that goes into being able to get these licenses, which I think it does, like you, to some extent, create a disparity, because we'll see that a lot of the licenses will either go to specifically Ghanaians who have the financial means or have access to foreign investment that can help bankroll some of these things, or people who have greater expertise in these things. Whereas when it comes to maybe people in rural areas, they might not see the benefits of having this policy in place, given that they're probably smaller scale and using things like growing cannabis just to try and subsidize some of their costs in being able to take care of their families. So given that it's probably not the primary crop of interest for them, it's not going to be something that is of significant relevance. So there's definitely going to be a disparity between who can actually grow those crops and who can actually access licensing. So that's what I think.
Yeah, but then if we look at Ghana, for instance, I think Ghana stands, its approach to this is quite distant, being the first in West Africa. And then again, what is the significance of Ghana's liberal approach to this at a time where you see other countries in the same region moving in the opposite direction, you know, create more harsh penalties for things like this? Do you think Ghana's approach or Ghana's legalization offers a lesson or kind of hope that the others might change, or does it, what does it signify in that region that has generally prohibited or stand harsh penalties, or, you know, harshly stood against cannabis?
So I think in the context of the West African region, it is a significant move, because there were other countries, for instance, like Sierra Leone, which had similar policies like presented to their cabinet, and they didn't make it through, I think, due to like a change of government. So I think this is a significant step within that region, given that it kind of gives almost like a contradictory dialogue to what's going on when you see that other countries within the region are still punitively addressing things like cannabis possession, and also like increasingly becoming restrictive to people who are maybe reliant on these cannabis-based economies. So in that context, I think it is very significant in the shift that it is taking. And I think it also provides like neighbors within the region a certain perspective to see, can this work out in our context? Is this something that we can look to ourselves? I think because there are a lot of shared cultural similarities maybe across the area, you will probably see a number of cultural groups, societies referencing Ghana when they talk about maybe looking towards doing something similar. So I think it is very significant in what it's doing with this policy. And I think just it takes time to see the effects of the policy. So I think neighbors are going to be cautious. They're going to be watching, and they're going to be curious to see what sort of impact it has on things like society, communities, and as well as financial implications too.
So when we look at the different countries that have legalized this, so what we see is like the significant variation in also, like you rightly mentioned, in Ghana, recreational use is prohibited, and I think they have up to about 10 years imprisonment for anyone caught with it. In South Africa, it's different. In Zimbabwe, in Lesotho, they have different. Can you explain these differentiations in their scope of legalization and the motivation behind? Is that of capacity, or do you have other kind of motivations that are different?
The differences that we see in how these policies are enacted on a community level comes down to, I think, a history of prohibition to drug use and, of course, cannabis use. So we saw that across Africa during colonization, the cultivation of cannabis significantly dropped. And during that same time, the United Nations also moved to enact cannabis as a substance that is of non-significant medical use and restricted. So a lot of countries also enacted those policies within their respective colonies. And that's what we saw in Africa. And then when we saw when we saw independence movements taking place across the continent, a lot of the colonial-based era laws during that time remained. And in some instances, they were actually changed so that they can be more stringent. And this was primarily due to the shift in mindset, where a lot of communities lost their connection to their cultures that were connected perhaps to traditional medicine use, which included things like cannabis. So a lot of those cultures lost that and shifted over to the, I guess, largely Western perspective of addressing drug use and cannabis use. Mm-hmm. So then within the society, it's become to be socially associated with things like criminality, defiance, delinquency as a youth, or just general moral decline rather than having any other specific things. So in general, if you hear the older generation in Africa, even the younger generation talk about cannabis, they still see it as something that is taboo. And the stigma still exists and transfers politically and culturally. So you can't have a political climate that isn't influenced by the cultural climate. So the cultural climate says that cannabis is taboo. So the political climate will try and somehow be able to appease that cultural climate. So it is something that is tricky to try and navigate when you see policies like this being enacted, where perhaps the government is trying to steer the community towards thinking of cannabis as something more than what the prohibitionist mindset has been for so long. So it's definitely interesting to see how cultural impact, what kind of cultural impacts will come from these kind of policies, where the government are saying something else relative to what the culture has been taught.
So what we're seeing, so let me bring this to actually the usage of drugs, because I know places in Nigeria, for instance, where we see a growing drug epidemic, where people kind of seek not just necessarily cannabis, but maybe some other tramadol, another kind of drug that they used to sometimes just escape the poverty or escape certain things that they do. And then we're looking at the youth bulge in those places and all of that. So I guess the question is, how do we formalize, does formalizing this kind of spaces, does it in a way help in, for instance, how can we formalize it? How can we, the educational system, to create like a healthy use of drugs? So I guess the question is, What is the conversation? What is the current conversation towards recreational use? Are we running away from what is reality? Is there any conversation around this place in the continent, whether in Ghana or any other places?
I think in terms of the conversation regarding recreational drug use, it's definitely a prohibitionist stance that still largely persists. Like you mentioned, there are epidemics of substance use that are presently like ongoing in certain contexts of Africa. Like you said, tramadol in places like West Africa. There's also things like Kush and things like Sierra Leone. So I think when people see that like their youth are being largely impacted by the use of these substances, I think people are very quick to say that the substances are bad and they have no purpose within our societies or culture. But I think I would argue that by saying that the context in which this substance use is occurring is not being largely considered as well. Like you said, there is a lot of youth use of substance use stemming from perhaps unemployment, trying to cope with not being able to provide for families, trying to cope with just a system that doesn't encourage progression as a youth. Mm-hmm. So using these substances becomes something that that is significant in that it gives them perhaps a sort of relief from what they're currently experiencing or what they can't navigate themselves in other avenues that might not be as harmful. So context is very important in terms of drug use. There is the use of substances to try and navigate certain challenges. There is the use of substances just to try and perhaps just to get high or relax. And there's also the use of substances to help you achieve certain goals. Like we see farmers in Morocco, they use certain, I believe, I want to say resin, but I will not. They use a certain variety of cannabis to help them deal with I guess the aches and pains of like harvesting certain crops. So you see that there is context to these cannabis uses and to overall drug use. And when we talk about trying to change policy, we need to understand what the current context is and what that means for the society at large. If we're going to legalize things like recreational use, we need to keep those things in mind. Can the current context handle having something like that legalized?
I'm glad you mentioned Morocco. So Morocco and some of the countries, I think maybe Cameroon as well, where there's no formal legalization, but again, the attitude towards it is less criminalized. Where is the criminalized? There's some sort of cultural acceptance. Can you speak on this? These countries that are not necessarily prohibitive towards this, but again, they are not formally legalizing them.
Yeah, so these countries would be considered quasi-legal in the sense that, like you said, they don't have formal legalization of cannabis, but there is sort of an acceptance to the significance of the plant in terms of what it does for economies, for communities, and for the culture. We see that in the Moroccan context, there is a region known specifically for cannabis use, for cannabis cultivation called the Rife region. So you see a lot of farmers there, they engage in cannabis cultivation. And it's actually something that's known by the legal authorities. The police know about it. And they understand that without this, a lot of the market economy within this region would not be feasible. Mm-hmm. So again, it comes back to the context of how the society understands this crop. it's definitely interesting to see within a country where on paper it says that this is illegal, but yet at the same time, when it's actually happening, the illegality of it seems to not be as relevant anymore. So I think there is a lesson from this in that perhaps we, as a continent, there can be space for cannabis, like sufficient cannabis cultivation and cannabis-based economies, if the community itself understands what exactly is happening and they know how to address what is happening and they know how to manage any sort of problems that come based off of the engaging in these cannabis-based economies and markets.
Let me come to the last question, and you started touching upon it with your last statement in terms of what needs to be done. So I guess the question is, if you look at it in different layers, what needs to be done? Why should the rest of African countries that have not legalized this thing, what should they do? How should they move? How should they, and then again, how can the continent itself protect itself and make the benefit not externalized? Because again, we see where most of the economy, Africa is at the periphery when it comes to its relations, trade relations with external. And then how can the needs of the people or the implications of drug use, how can all of this be done? You started with education and awareness, trying to well. So I wanted to speak more on that and conclude on that, just more broadly, and maybe spend in specific countries as well, if you put it.
I think the main point is probably that legalization or any sort of less prohibitive shift in cannabis policy, if there isn't inclusion of context and community, it simply replaces one unequal system for another. We see countries like Lesotho, like I mentioned before, where licensing alone didn't really transform the lives of the people themselves. Mm-hmm. You see that export markets would grow, like export markets within these countries that shifted their policy in a similar way to Ghana right now, you see that there is growth, significant growth in those markets. However, like informal farmers or cannabis farming communities remain excluded. And even in the context of these policies where they state that the cultivation of cannabis is for medicinal purposes, but there isn't a specific framework that provides specific access to cannabis products for patients if they wanted it. Apart from countries like South Africa, Seychelles again, they do have specific medicinal cannabis framework for accessing things like cannabis. However, in the same line, in trying to access cannabis as perhaps a patient within Africa, there do still exist significant barriers at the medical level in terms of finding doctors or pharmacists who are knowledgeable enough about these things. So there does need to be an education aspect within that sort of setting as well. And that can also extend to educating the public as well regarding drug use and cannabis use. So there is a need for education at different levels regarding what this sort of policy kind of means for people and what further shifts in this policy could potentially look like. There needs to be greater training and outreach. And I think there needs to be a shift in understanding how success within these policy regimes are measured. Like we can't solely look at success as something that is related to the numbers of licenses issued or the level of foreign investment or the level of product that is grown. Success should be something that's looked at more from the lens of, okay, we've changed the cannabis policy, but has this resulted in declines in criminalization of people? Has this resulted in healthcare access improvements, or have rural livelihoods become more secure because of this option for people who might be looking to diversify their crop supplies? So I think it's something that needs to be reframed, especially if we're looking forward into trying to understand what success would look like within our context of like enacting these policies. I think looking at the future of cannabis policy, it's definitely something that is not going to be easy if we're trying to be more relevant in the global dialogue in a way that is maybe not similar, but maybe parallel with countries that are now moving away from traditional prohibitionist policies. There is a lot of work that needs to be done to get us to that point. And it starts with education. It starts with talking to communities. It starts with providing adequate resources to certain people who might benefit from these policies the most. I think cannabis policy isn't really about the plant itself. It's more about who gets punished and who gets protected, and who also gets to profit. So I think that's like the key takeaway.
Chana, it's been an interesting conversation. I really enjoyed this conversation, and thank you once again for coming on this podcast. And I wish you the best in your research, which I find very, very interesting, and you know, very exciting. We don't talk about these things that often. Like Riley said, education is the key, which I've always stressed as well in my own research, that we need a lot of real education, real awareness in the continent. But thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your morning. It looks sunny out there. I guess is it the time of the year when you guys enjoy a good weather?
Yes, it is. It's just I have some pretty bad allergies, so that's been making it difficult to enjoy. But thank you again for having me.
All right, you have a nice day, and I'll be in touch shortly.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Bye. Thank you for joining in today, and as usual, join me to thank our guest, Chana Kitchen, for her very useful and rich insights into the subject of cannabis legalization. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.